He was named a Gladstone Professor of Government and Public Administration. Professor Beloff's interest in young people and in liberal education resulted in his association at this time with a university college at Buckingham, a new private innovative institution of which he is now principal. Our speaker is known on both sides of the Atlantic for his many books and lectures on American political and institutional history, on Soviet policy and international affairs. His topic this evening is the United Kingdom breaking up? Professor Beloff.
Dean Will, ladies and gentlemen, having arrived back in Canada today from a foreign country a few miles away, where I have been touring for the last 3.5 weeks, talking about the affairs of Britain, I gather that there may have been some misunderstanding as to what was implied in my title for this evening's occasion. In the United States, I was talking somewhat generally about the problems that Britain faces and making the general case, which I believe to be true, that the problems from which Britain is notably suffering, problems that are both economic and social, arise from causes that are common to all the advanced industrial countries of the West, and that whether they are soluble in the British case is probably of great moment to all other countries, since sooner or later, and in many cases sooner rather than later, they will find the same problems facing them. How in a welfare state one controls public expenditure and makes certain of its proper application, how one runs effectively a mixed economy divided between public and private enterprise, how in an age when people assume a constant rise in the standard of living, one manages to achieve growth without inflation. All these questions are, I think, in different, to different degrees, as relevant to the situation here in the United States, in continental Western Europe, as they are to Britain. And for various reasons, which I think are historical in the light of Britain's pioneering role, first in the Industrial Revolution, and then in the operation of a welfare state, they may be confronted more directly and, in some people's opinions, more dramatically in Britain, but are not unique. This evening, however, I do not wish to talk about anything as general as that. When I proposed and your committee selected the title, Is the United Kingdom Breaking Up?, I was thinking of it in a much more restricted sense. That is to say, will the unitary form that the government of the United Kingdom has taken since the early 18th century survive certain pressures upon it in favor of local autonomy or of independence of the units of which the United Kingdom is made up. And this also, a question which is much raised, is also a particular example of something which is generic to our age, which is found in many other countries, and most particularly, perhaps today, in Western Europe, with which Britain, as a result of last summer's referendum, is now so closely and, in my view, definitively associated. The question poses itself something in this way. Recent decades have seen in Europe, and to some extent in other parts of the world, a movement towards transcending the boundaries of the traditional nation state as we have known it for the last two or three centuries, in favor of various forms of international or supranational organization, of which the European Economic Community is the most novel in form and the most far-reaching in purpose. The national governments have therefore lost, or are in the process of losing as the community develops, powers that they previously exercised as those of sovereign nations. They have lost already the power, for instance, to regulate external trade. They may, if present plans reach fruition, lose the power to control the issue of their own currency, its rate of exchange, credit policy, and so forth. Many things which we would have thought of as essential to any national government have been or are in process of being surrendered. But by a curious and, in the case of the larger countries, an almost universal paradox, at the same time, we see in many of these countries a growing movement in the opposite direction, towards the diffusion of power not to a new center, but away from the center to the periphery. We see claims to greater autonomy for regions which are smaller than that of the nation state, particularly where, as in many, though not all cases, the regions are inhabited by peoples who have some claim to a separate identity, ethnic, linguistic, historical, religious, so that they could claim to the status of a nationality or of a subnationality. The headlines have most recently been made by the Basques and the Catalans in Spain. But we see the same tendency towards a claim for a greater say in their own affairs of the Bretons and the Corsicans in France. And in some countries, where, as for instance in Belgium, you have two sub-nationalities of almost equal strength, all political life depends upon maintaining a series of very complex and difficult bargains between them. So that we find a curious, as I say, a curious and paradoxical situation by which the power that was allotted or came to be exercised by the nation state is now drained away, on the one hand towards something larger and on the other towards smaller units. It is, I think, easy to see why this should be so, in principle. It is obvious that our modern governments do a great deal more than their predecessors, interfere with the ordinary course of life, intervene in the ordinary activities of the citizen, to a much greater extent than was common a century ago. And in such circumstances, it is natural that people should attach great importance to being able to influence the action of government so that it redounds to their benefit. And if they happen to reside on the periphery of some state, in locations far removed from the national capital, they will claim or believe to exist imperfections in their access to the authorities. And if they feel that the national government is powerless to meet their demands, possibly because it has already allocated some powers to a more far-reaching organization, they will feel this frustration even more strongly. It is, however, also easy to see that these claims are likely to be resisted, both at the center and on the spot. For the claims that are advanced by peripheral regions are usually, not always, but usually economic. But if they gain independence or a great measure of autonomy, they may actually lose out economically if it involves sacrificing access to central funds. In other words, the peripheral regions wish to be in a position to benefit by the redistribution of funds drawn from the economy as a whole through taxation or borrowing powers, and this can only be done if the center remains strong. It is a problem particularly familiar to those who live, as you do, in a federal system, and therefore I need hardly dwell on it here. But the argument, though often primarily economic, is of course not a simply an economic one in most cases. It may be a question of the disadvantages attached to a local language. Although one could argue that this is not a purely cultural matter, since unless a local language is fully recognized, the initial education or training in it may produce a disadvantage for the individual concerned. And in the great multinational empires, whether one looks at the pre-1914 empires in Europe or at post-imperial countries such as India, language is the great solvent of unity, particularly with general literacy and a generally increased concern as to the language in which reading and writing is done. Or you may get, and in some cases do get, for instance, among the Basques, an even more straightforward form of nationalism, simply a feeling that an historic language or culture or mode of religious belief is threatened by the activities of a centralizing state and the increasing contact with other tempting cultural forms that an incorporation into such a larger state often denotes. We're talking about things and situations which in many cases have gone on for centuries. And one of the interesting side issues which is raised by these problems is that it would appear that there is no period of history long enough for one to be able to say that the issue is now settled. Brittany, for instance, to take an example outside the United Kingdom, has been a part of the state of France, first of the French monarchy and then of the French Republic, for well over 400 years, and yet the issue of its relations with the rest of France would still appear to be in part an open one. But if these relations have persisted over centuries, it is likely, and it is indeed true of most cases, that there has been a sizable migration from the majority area to the minority area, or that part of the minority population will have been attracted by the culture of the majority and assimilated to it. And this means that even in the local instance, on the periphery itself, there will be opposition to any change of status. Internal migration of this kind may be the result of unplanned and uncoordinated migration by individuals seeking their own better fortune, or it may be something that governments directly encourage in order to prevent these centrifugal tendencies from affecting the strength of the system as a whole. For instance, we know that the Soviet government has encouraged such movements throughout its history so as to create majorities of Russian speakers in the other republics that make up, with the Russians, the Soviet Union. The old Irish question, as it existed in 19th century British history and down to the Treaty of 1921, was a classic example of a situation of this kind, where the original incorporation of the area within a larger unity also involved a large degree of settlement by the bearers of the language and culture of the majority. And the solution of the old Irish question in the Treaty of 1921, which with successive steps led up to the establishment of the modern Republic of Ireland, might be regarded as the first stage in a breakup of the United Kingdom, and was by the opponents of that treaty so regarded at the time. The situation we confront today in Northern Ireland, or Ulster, is a different one. And as far as the centrifugal tendencies within the United Kingdom are concerned, the most alive and menacing one. Because the history of Northern Ireland since 1921 might be held to show that a mere devolution of power, the mere allocation of more power to a peripheral province, may not be a solution for the problem that it poses, and may indeed make the problem worse. What I would like to try to do this evening is to bring the Ulster experience to assist us in analysing the other two serious problems that confront those who believe in the value of a continued unitary form for the government of the United Kingdom, the case of Scotland and the case of Wales. I am assuming, but history could again prove one wrong, that the claims of Cornwall to independent status are different, are purely antiquarian, since the situation of Cornwall does not seem to differ sufficiently from what may be felt about a sense of distance from decision making in London by regions that are clearly part of England proper, the northwest or the northeast. In Ulster, after 1921, one had a classic case of two irreconcilable sections of the population dominated by diverse and to some extent hostile ideologies. The majority community, roughly two-thirds of the total, was strongly attached to the United Kingdom and the Protestant religion, and wished to be distinguished in no way from the people of other British regions. One-third of the population was, on the contrary, Irish, not British, in sentiment, in the local circumstances, meaning Roman Catholic in religion, and did not, in 1921, clearly have any wish to be part and parcel of any state other than a united Ireland. The form of devolution, both in legislative matters and in administration, that Ulster had between 1921 and 1972 was an attempt to meet the demands of both sections of the population, both the majority and the minority, by leaving Ulster as an integral part of the United Kingdom, but emphasizing its special status and leaving it open to revision if the majority came to feel, as they have clearly not yet come to feel, that they would do better in as part of a united Ireland rather than as part of the United Kingdom. As so often with political compromises, worked out as this one was in the heat of a civil war, or a quasi-civil war, the result did not wholly satisfy either side in the conflict. The majority sacrificed that full representation in the Westminster Parliament to which its population would have entitled it, and therefore lost some of the leverage on national policy that it might otherwise have had. The minority were not only obliged from their point of view to remain on the wrong side of what ultimately became an international frontier, but felt themselves excluded from a share in the government of the region, and in a region which was constantly subject to particular economic problems to a greater extent than the rest of the United Kingdom, they felt that they were also the subjects of discrimination in many matters affecting their economic well-being. The situation was further complicated when the original Irish Free State within the Commonwealth became an independent country as the Republic of Ireland and had in its constitution and in its public image a formal commitment to the unity of the whole island as its ultimate goal. The arrangements made at the time, which are unique among sovereign states, the arrangements for free movement between the Republic and the United Kingdom, and for Irish citizens resident in Britain to be able to vote, gave the Irish opponents of partition, as they termed it, a hold in mainland British politics, which is not altogether without its importance. Something like 1 million votes, 84% of them normally voting for the Labour Party, worth to that party something perhaps between 6 and 11 seats in a general election. If we look at the situation 5 years ago, however, there might have seemed to be some grounds for reasoned optimism. On the one side, with the long duration of this arrangement, there appeared to be some indication that the elements of discrimination against the minority were weakening. And on the Irish side of the border, as the Irish Republic prospered, there were signs that the notion of partition being ended were among those elements in a political creed that remain formal, but not an immediate call to action. And one of the problems is, why in this situation, when on the whole there were grounds for reasoned optimism on the face of it, there should have been a revival of violence on a scale which made the continuation of a system of devolved power impossible, and the imposition of direct rule from Westminster the only obvious alternative to an escalation of violence leading to actual civil war. I think myself that we would probably never be able to establish local reasons why this should have been so. I suspect it may have been connected with the general recourse to violence in politics by quite small minorities, which has been a feature of the last decade in very many parts of the world. Imitation, in this as in other matters, is a possibly underrated factor, particularly among the young. And if one looks at the most publicized incidents involving violence on behalf of the Republican minority in Northern Ireland, one can see how young the participants nearly always are. Furthermore, of course, since any weakening of a country of the Western Alliance, such as Britain, was in the interest either of these international movements or of their ultimate suppliers of funds and weapons, it was much easier to start and to fuel a terrorist movement than it had been in the past. And as we know, to our cost in many countries, the new arms which the progress, if that's the right word, of technology has been made available to terrorists also make the task of security forces technically much more difficult than, say, in the middle of the 19th century. In this particular case, the Northern Irish case, we must remember that the terrorists have on their side certain advantages which are probably essential to their ability so far to prevent the peaceful settlement of the actual constitutional problem to which it would seem the vast majority of both the Northern Irish communities are pledged. For one thing, although the terrorists are as much of a threat and an open threat to the government of the Irish Republic as to the authorities in Ulster, the Irish government, for understandable sentimental reasons, stretching back, once again we see how long history is, stretching back into the distant past, cannot collaborate too openly with the British government in suppressing terrorism, for instance, by extraditing offenders. And again, this is a question of imitation, the sentimentality which in our days seems to be afforded to all criminals who can claim a political purpose for their crimes helps there in Ireland, among the Irish community in England, and in the United States to find sympathy, funds, and arms. In a curious and indeed tragic way, the upshot of this is that we have in Northern Ireland a situation rare but perhaps not unique in political affairs where none of the parties involved can possibly get what it is they are after. They can, at best, only secure negative victories. Violence by members of the minority community has, as was bound to be the case, led to retaliation by the majority. Both sides are thus led to believe the worst of each other, and an agreed political settlement between them, the sharing of power in some new constitutional structure, becomes unacceptable. Such a settlement cannot at the moment be imposed by the United Kingdom government on the majority population in Northern Ireland, because, as already been seen on one celebrated occasion, its control of the trade union movement there means that industrial power is available to bring down any regime to which the Protestant majority are implacably opposed. On the other hand, it is hard to see that the terrorists can gain their objective either. If they achieve what would appear to be their objective, which is so to sicken the rest of the United Kingdom of the affairs of Ulster that the government is forced to wash its hands of it, the result would not be an end of partition, which is their proclaimed objective, but a declaration of independence by the majority community in Northern Ireland, a community which would be successful in any overt conflict unless the minority received military help from the South, which it would be most unlikely to do. There are possibly other situations elsewhere in the world, one thinks of the Middle East, where while it is obvious what needs to be done politically, and where one can see the outlines of a political situation, this is constantly rendered impossible by the activities of quite small groups who can mar the situation but not make one. Therefore, the lives sacrificed and property destroyed in Ulster, and to a lesser, but now not in considerable extent, in Britain itself, are lost or destroyed for no real tangible purpose. And there can now only be a solution imposed from the outside by the agreement of the two governments concerned, that of the United Kingdom and that of the Irish Republic. Under some circumstances, it is conceivable that one could have an independent Ulster, though not one of the present size, and not one which could come into existence without a forcible exchange of populations, a sort of Cyprus solution. But a diminished and independent Ulster would, as the economic record shows, have a much lower standard of living than the rest of the United Kingdom. And this would no doubt in turn bring about new problems. That solution, therefore, an independent Ulster, must also, I think, be ruled out. Ulster thus remains, and it may remain for some time, a very difficult problem and a painful and tragic one, but not, I think, because of its particularity, a matter of make or break for the unity of the United Kingdom. But I think it is worth bearing in mind when devolution is suggested as a solution for the problem or the claims of Wales and Scotland, where, thankfully, violence to persons is so far unknown and violence to property insignificant. What is proposed to be done about the claims of these two countries? We do not yet know. A great deal of discussion has gone on, but as is perhaps characteristic of our times, largely in private. Scotland and Wales must, I think, be taken together, despite the obvious differences in the situation of the two countries and in the character of their national movements. For one thing, the historical origin of their participation in the United Kingdom is quite different. Wales was conquered more than once during the Middle Ages and was finally reduced to obedience to the central government by the end of the 14th century. Scotland entered a voluntary union only a mere less than three centuries ago. Wales is culturally still, despite its long connection with England, in part unsubdued. It has retained, in part, a language which is wholly distinct from English and belongs to a different linguistic family. It has had a very different religious tradition. In Scotland, on the other hand, because of the internal history of Scotland itself, the domination of the whole country by the Lowlands, language is not an important aspect of its claims to a separate identity. Wales, again, has been much more thoroughly incorporated with the rest of the country. Its law, its system of local government, its administrative system, and the degree of devolution in it are still quite restricted. It is, apart from this general belief where it exists in national identity, much more difficult to pick out what distinguishes Wales from England. In Scotland, however, because of the provisions of the original Act of Union, there is still a separate system of law, a different and partially separate system of education, and of course, a separate ecclesiastical settlement. Again, while Scotland, for geographical reasons, has some of the characteristics of an independent economy, Wales is much more closely intertwined with the economy of England. Its main lines of communication, for instance, run to centres in England rather than across the country itself. And although there is some parallel between the revival of the two nationalist movements in recent years, they have taken very different forms and still do. For instance, in the recent referendum on membership of the European Community, while the voting in Wales paralleled the voting in England, that is to say, was rather lower in areas of traditional heavy industry and rather higher in other areas, in Scotland generally, the vote against membership was higher. One similarity is that both of them, in terms of population, are overrepresented in the Westminster Parliament. This has been part of the bargain. It was true, of course, of Ireland before 1921, though, as I have said, it is not true of Ulster, which is underrepresented. This is not merely because the British method of fixing parliamentary boundaries gives a certain weightage to sparsely inhabited rural areas. Wales has 36 seats in the Westminster Parliament, where population would indicate that it should have 31. Scotland has 71, where population would suggest 57. And this is true of the urban areas as well. Birmingham, the second city of the kingdom, with 647,000 voters, has 11 members. Glasgow, with 579,000 voters, has 13. Cardiff has 4 members of parliament, while the English cities of similar size only get 3 each. And this is very closely intertwined with what has developed as the characteristic party political situation in the United Kingdom. In both Scotland and Wales, as with the Irish vote in England, the Labour Party has been the great gainer. In all years, except those when the country swings very heavily towards Labour, Labour governments have been dependent on Welsh and Scottish votes. And this explains the extreme sensitivity of the Labour Party to any question of a serious measure of devolution, let alone independence, in the case of either country. Because if greater powers were given to a Scottish or a Welsh assembly or parliament, the English would be bound to demand that their representation at Westminster should be cut down, and this would have an unequal effect upon the major British parties. At one time, the Conservatives were to some extent compensated by being able to rely on Ulster members of Parliament, but this support has now disappeared. If one could contemplate either total independence for Wales and Scotland or a federal form of government, one would then, of course, have an English Parliament for the first time since 1707, as well as Scottish and Welsh Parliaments. And on past showing, England would normally have a Conservative government. But when this has been said as indicating the extent to which the two situations are parallel, they are in other respects very divergent. The 11 Scottish nationalists and 3 Welsh nationalists in the present British Parliament in fact represent quite different kinds of movements and quite different kinds of parties. And therefore, we have to take them separately. First, the Scots. Many aspects of the problem of Scottish nationalism are conjectural. The demise of the movement is recurrently forecast. But recently, each time it is thought to be dead, something happens, a spectacular win in a parliamentary by-election or in local government, which seems to put it on the map again. But much more obscure is what is meant by those who vote for the Scottish National Party. Do they mean a wholly independent Scotland? Is this what they are seeking? Or is this just a rather dramatic form of bringing pressure on central government to do more about Scotland's problems? In other words, is nationalism in Scotland just an exaggeration of that regional sense of grievance, of distance from central government, which, as I began by saying, would appear to be almost universal in the larger European countries? Furthermore, one has, in Scotland, to a much greater extent than in Wales, an important element in the population, particularly in the more educated elements, which is very anglicised and which regards participation in the United Kingdom and its affairs as essential for its own well-being. This is one reason why, while in nearly all countries which have nationalist movements, the universities tend to be their focus, the universities of Scotland are among the chief opponents of any concessions to a Scottish national identity. Until a decade ago, it was relatively easy to dismiss the Scottish case as a typical example of this sense of underprivilege on the part of a poorer peripheral region. Because of the historical development of its basic industries, Scotland was generally less favourably placed in economic matters than England. It therefore was more concerned to bring pressure on central government to direct investment towards it in order to make up for the decline of some of its traditional industries, coal mining, shipbuilding. And therefore, a system which would have removed the element of redistribution in being part of a single system was something which it was easy to argue against. In other words, like Ulster, though in a less direct fashion, Scotland benefited through its access to the greater wealth of England. It is now argued that the discovery and exploitation of oil in the North Sea has changed the situation for good. It is now argued, as part of the nationalist case, that if the oil resources were treated as Scotland's own and not shared with the rest of the United Kingdom, Scotland would be richer than England, and given full self-government, could use its new wealth to tackle its own problems. The difficulty about this argument, as indeed about most other economic calculations, is that one would have to know in some detail the terms of separation and the policies which an independent Scotland might adopt. The Scottish Nationalist Party campaigned against British membership of the European Community, although with little impact on the Scottish vote, and indeed has clearly benefited greatly from membership. But if Scotland persisted in remaining outside, then of course there would be a tariff boundary between Scotland and England. And this makes it very difficult to calculate the future course of Scottish trade. Also, one could ask, are the Scots right in believing that they are better than running things than the English? This is a very delicate question. But some people would say that the worst run of major British cities, the most ineffective municipal government, is that of Glasgow. And why should the Scots be better at running their country than they are at running their own largest city? One thing that is certain, and that to some extent justifies the claims made by the Scottish National Party, is that what has made governments susceptible to Scottish claims is the rise of that party. The rise at the last general election to securing over 30% of the vote in the country. It is true that this rise in the vote of the Scottish Nationalist Party has been mainly at the expense of the Conservatives, and may have been due in part to the particular weaknesses of the Conservative Party in Scotland. But the margin by which Labour holds a number of seats where the Scottish Nationalists are pressing upon them is quite small. One further push could bring a number of Labour seats tumbling down. But this electoral situation is not as simple as that, because it presents the Scottish Nationalist Party with a problem. So far, its main appeal has clearly been to those who in other circumstances have voted Conservative or Liberal. But like all nationalist movements, it has some flavour of socialism about it. But if this were to develop, if it were to move to the left in order to win industrial seats at present held by Labour, would it not then lose some of its existing support? It has been interesting for the student of political institutions to look at the reaction of the main British parties to this relatively new situation. The Liberals, who are most directly threatened for their foothold in Scotland, tend to meet the situation by voicing very much the same claims as the nationalists themselves, though without going to the length of total independence. But both the present government and the present opposition, the present Conservative opposition, did commit themselves at the last election to some kind of elected assembly for Scotland. If it were elected by the direct vote, as the British Parliament is, and if the Scottish Nationalist Party were to push up its vote by a few more percent, the workings of an electoral system of this kind might give it an overall majority in such an assembly. And therefore, there is some inclination to suggest that proportional representation for a Scottish assembly would be safer. But if proportional representation for Scotland were adopted, then the argument against it in England would become weaker, and this leaves the government in something of a dilemma. But more important than the question of what such an assembly would be or how it would be elected is the powers that it would be granted. Since Scotland is primarily administered not from London but from Edinburgh, it is easy to draw up a list of things which such an assembly could discuss or question or scrutinise. But this would hardly meet the claim of Scottish nationalists that the important issue is where economic power is to lie. That is to say, unless an assembly were given independent powers of taxation and some powers of economic control, it would hardly meet the case. That is to say that those who argue, and very powerfully, that there are certain legislative attributes that such an assembly could adopt, particularly in the sphere of private law, where it is difficult to give due weight to the different Scottish system when legislation is being hurriedly passed through the Westminster Parliament, arguments of this kind, which much appeal to the Scottish legal profession, really evade the main issue. The main issue remains the economic one. If, however, economic powers are not devolved, then the assembly would simply become, if experience with other national movements is to be used as a precedent, would merely become a platform from which to claim further powers. In other words, the question is, can one kill with kindness? My own feeling is that a halfway house of this kind, an assembly without real powers, is unlikely to satisfy and may indeed make the situation more difficult. It does seem, in the light of the experience of federal countries and other forms of devolution, to see how one can devolve more than very limited forms of taxation, such as local authorities enjoy, without a direct effect on the economy, or give such an assembly powers over social services without affecting the movement of labour through the country, or how one could give control of one part of the economy, say energy, without the rest. In nearly all countries, the tendency in relation to local government, and in federal countries in relation to the states or provinces, has been increased central control through the ultimate power of the purse. It is difficult to see why the United Kingdom should be an exception. That means that if one is going to start on the road to devolution, one might perhaps go for a full federalist or confederalist system. But this would again be difficult to manage, since all viable federal systems have got central economic controls, and most of them, with the exception of Switzerland, are geographically much larger. Furthermore, it's difficult to see that one could, in fact, think of a formula for Scotland and do less for Wales. And a federation of less than four units, assuming that Ulster recovered its powers of self-government, is very difficult to conceive, and all efforts at creating such federations have in fact collapsed. And here one comes to the differential in the Welsh case. Welsh nationalism, as I've said, is historically quite different. It is in essence cultural, with language and literature central to it. But those elements of differentiation are in fact declining. By 1961, only 1% of the population spoke Welsh alone, and only 26% were bilingual. There had been, and this is common with the peripheral situations in many countries, a retreat to the more sparsely populated areas and the more remote highland districts. And this is where the strength of Welsh nationalism lies. From time to time, as economic troubles emerge, discontent with the policies of successive governments, and in the south with the long monopoly by the Labour Party of the control of local government, leads to temporary election successes. But in Wales, since conservatism is very weak, this means that the struggle is largely over the direction of potentially Labour votes. Even, however, at a peak, as at the last general election, the Welsh Nationals' performance by no means equals the achievement of the Scots. While the Scottish Nationalist Party got 30%, the Welsh Nationalist Party got only 10%. And it is difficult to see a claim for devolution based on the wishes of 10% of the population. This situation has three consequences, or three symptoms, which are perhaps worth mentioning in passing. In the first place, while Scottish nationalism on matters other than the situation of Scotland covers a rather wide spectrum, the Welsh nationalists are definitely a party of the left. Its members in the Westminster Parliament are normally regarded as an automatic part of the Labour Party's votes. And therefore, in this situation, their bargaining power, quite irrespective of numbers, is smaller. Again, like other examples of linguistic nationalism, the university in Wales is a great focus for such activities. It is there that the battle against further Anglicisation is fought. And this, again, as I have shown, is very different from the situation in Scotland. Most important of all, however, is that the language issue, which is the core of the case, is also a divisive one, since if, by some chance, Wales were to become an independent country, Welsh speakers would still be very heavily outnumbered. And there is a fear on the part of the majority population that any movement towards a greater degree of autonomy would mean a demand that English speakers learned Welsh, that otherwise their education and job prospects would be limited. And as we know from experience in many parts of the world, in many periods, this is an extremely inflammatory issue. It is much harder to get a majority to learn a minority language than vice versa. Nevertheless, the central fact is the one with which I began, that while it is possible that if you regard North Sea oil as a Scottish rather than a British resource, one could imagine Scotland as a separate economy, rather in the way that Norway is, Norway being at the moment the country to which Scotland most frequently points, for an example, Wales cannot be thought of in this way. Wales requires England and different parts of England for its trade, for tourism, for opportunities of employment. North Wales looks across the Mersey, South Wales across the Severn. And to charge more for Wales's water is not a real parallel to charging more for Scotland's oil. And again, administrative decentralisation, which has taken place in Wales, though not to the same extent as Scotland, does not altogether meet feelings of neglect, which are the common factor in areas on the periphery. Anglesey is more difficult to reach from Cardiff than it is from London, just as the Highlands of Scotland don't think of Edinburgh quite as much as their capital, as nationalist talk would sometimes lead one to believe. Furthermore, when one comes to the argument that the proper thing in this case would be to revive the regions of England, the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms that existed before the Norman conquest or before Alfred, the degree of artificiality is so great and the absence of any demand is so obvious that one is beginning to do things which could only be justified by some intense belief in uniformity. Enlightened self-interest would, I think, retain the United Kingdom as it is. The trouble is that with the Ulster issue in mind, and indeed with other parallels in other parts of the world, one is left with a nagging feeling that on this kind of issue, enlightened self-interest is not always conclusive. People are moved by symbol and by comparison. Not only Norway, but a great many other members of the United Nations could be looked at, and it could be pointed out that they have much less to commend them in terms of population or resources or area than either Scotland or Wales. Therefore, the conclusion is, I think, that it is only if there were a further deterioration in the British economy and a further loss of confidence in Britain's capacity to deal with it that these movements would become a serious threat. It is the strains on the function of the United Kingdom in the light of the present world recession, in the present combination common to all our countries of inflation and unemployment, not in the intrinsic appeal of the nationalist cause, that the problem lies. In good times, the strong bargaining position that the Scottish members of Parliament particularly hold should go on ensuring a voice for Scotland's needs sufficient to prevent a majority following the road of independence. And the danger would seem to be, if history is a guide, would seem to lie in believing that half measures would somehow or other make the problem go away. I believe in all this that the argument for British membership of Europe, which after all the Scots in their majority accepted if by a slightly lesser margin than that in England or Wales, that the argument for Europe is a very important one. The original Act of Union gave the Scots access to the then British Empire and to its successors. It enabled a relatively poor country to find careers, lay and secular, engineers and missionaries, all over the world. The Scots should, in Europe, find particular advantages. They have, in part, a history closely connected with some of our European neighbours. They have in their legal system a more direct access to some of the ideas that are important as this community develops. And even their great new resource, oil, might be said to be an argument for remaining within a larger unit, since although countries with single valuable resources may have from time to time a very high bargaining power, history also shows that a single asset is also a vulnerable one. For these reasons, I am on the whole inclined to think, as you may have guessed, that the answer is the United Kingdom is not going to break up.
Professor Baloff has agreed to answer some questions. We have time for some. In asking your question, would you please speak up and to the point? Does anyone have any questions that you'd like to put to Professor Baloff? Yes, up here.
Near the beginning of your talk, you made reference to peripheral fragmentation within many countries in Europe. Do you see any evidence of this occurring in Switzerland?
No. On the whole, the Swiss have lived with the differentiation of religion and language for centuries. They have a uniquely successful political system, which, alas, no one seems able to profit by other than the Swiss. And, of course, they are very different from the countries to which I was referring in that their system of government is not unitary. I was referring to the feelings of peripheral regions in highly centralized countries such as Britain, France, and Spain.
Further questions?
Oh, people are always taking polls, but I myself am very sceptical about what you can deduce from them, because what one needs to know is what people mean by what they say, and I've never taken very seriously the answer to hypothetical questions. What I think are the hard evidence that we have is the actual evidence of voting, and given the frequency of recent general elections and the regularity of local elections, it is possible to, I think, trace the actual movements of support for political parties without much recourse to polling data.
Certain groups, like the Greater London Council,
Well, this, of course, has already happened. The local government changes in Scotland, which have only very recently gone into operation, have created five or six regions, of which, of course, the largest, Strathclyde, which includes the whole of the Glasgow area and the related industrial towns, is about half the country in population, though not in area, and certainly has the same powers already as the Greater Manchester Authority or the West Midland Authority or the Greater London Council. In fact, this is another argument used against the setting up of a Scottish Assembly, that this would have a very complicated tier of governments if you were to put it above an already existing, as it were, super tier of local government. Well, what local government can do in the British system is restricted in terms of the overall control of finance and policy by central government. The degree of autonomy that local governments have is restricted. They have, of course, very considerable autonomy in the administration of services. But the kind of taxation which they have available, which is only rates, property taxes, is not sufficiently elastic to enable them to embark on policies of their own, and therefore the Scottish nationalists have by no means been mollified by the creation of the new Scottish regions.
Dr. Cobb at the back.
I have in the past in Canada incautiously taken part in discussions on Canadian internal politics. One of the few unbreakable resolutions of my life is never to repeat that error. Not really. The Irish at the beginning, the Irish Republic at its beginnings, made great efforts, at least on paper, to revive for official use a language which was spoken by a smaller proportion, a very considerably smaller proportion of the population than spoke Welsh at that time. And this has not been a success, except perhaps on paper. One can get around Ireland quite nicely, I understand, with English. But one could argue that it has not been necessary, since Ireland having achieved total political independence, the necessity of using language as a differential was less than when it was part of a larger system. And therefore, it is hard, I think, from this to go to look at the situation in Wales. I find it hard to think. I think that the language issue has played a much greater part in Welsh nationalism, the sense of the loss of what is still a living linguistic tradition. So that I think that the situations are really too distinct for one to be able to draw any serious comparison between them.
I believe there's time for one more question.
What are the chances of the recovery of the British economy?
What are the chances of a recovery in the world economy? I see reasons for particular difficulties in the case of Britain, which may be in process of being remedied, since they largely arose from a particular set of illusions as to how Britain could best survive in the very different circumstances of the present. If those lessons are learnt, and there is evidence that they are being learnt, painfully, but not to an inconsiderable degree, and if, as one hopes, there is a reasonable reaction to the current similar problems in other advanced industrial countries, I would expect in 10 years' time that we shall all be in much the same place.
I would like to call on Professor W.J. Stankiewicz to thank the speaker.
Professor Bieloff, Dr. Will, ladies and gentlemen. We have all listened to Professor Bieloff with very great interest, trying to come to grips with the problems epitomized in the somewhat ominous title, Is the United Kingdom Breaking Up? We all know of Britain's economic and other difficulties, of her increasing political malaise, but are we ready to admit that things have gone that far? Professor Bieloff's talk made me think of a contrasting opinion which prevailed only a few years ago and which regarded Britain's socio-political system as a naturally developing structure that was in harmony with the spirit of the people. It suggested that the British constitutional tradition requires only to be carried on and that the existing machinery would be successful in coping with the crisis at hand. Times have obviously changed, and there is a growing realization that the British political structure may need a major overhaul. At this juncture, the problem is that the public should be reminded that in the past, Britain has resorted to a large number of constitutional and parliamentary methods, practices, and experiments, that many of these practices have been very successful, and that the real task now is to find the courage to seek new solutions and to change the breaking up into a process of transformation. Although it was the Canadian Vincent Massey who said that the toleration of differences is the measure of civilization, this virtue itself must be seen as the essence of the British political tradition. And this alone should give us hope. Professor Bieloff's realistic and clear-sighted appraisal should be make us aware of where the possibilities for solutions might lie, and his forceful exposition and his historical sense reinforce our feeling of hope. We are offering to Professor Bieloff our hearty thanks for a lecture which we have heard with great appreciation.
I would like to draw everyone's attention to next week's lecture by Dr. Norman McKenzie. Our audience this year have been record audiences, and we do want to keep that to be the case. Dr. McKenzie is known to many Institute members, particularly in connection with his long association with Britain's Open University. I do hope that and welcome you all to come next week.